this afternoon. There'll be several hundred Esthers running around this building in all of their mother's finery. They'll come in all sizes up to about 3 feet. And they're acting out, dressing up to the memory of the quintessential Jewish heroine, Esther. For the qualities of courage and beauty are certainly the absolute perfect qualities for a heroine. And those Esther possessed apparently in great, great quality. What I'd like to do this morning, however, is to take another look at Esther and at the book of Esther, to take a look at it from the perspective of the last half of the 20th century, when all of us have become more sensitive to the feminine consciousness. And when we do so, and we don't so much lose our respect for Esther as we begin to understand better the long struggle which has taken place in and outside of our tradition for half the world to gain their place in the sun. You know, if there were to be the Miss Persia contest in which Esther won the crown, and it were to take place today, I suspect that a number of the more vociferous of women's groups might well be picketing that that beauty contest. And the courage of Esther lay in the fact that she was willing to brave the disfavor of her husband. When knowledge came to her of Haman's plan to destroy all the Jews, Esther was a logical one to speak to the king about it. She was the queen. He was her husband. But in ancient Persia, even the queen was not allowed to intrude into the apartment of the king unless she was invited, called for. And since the date of the execution of the Jews had been set, Esther could not wait for that moment. And so she took her life in her hands and went to the apartment of the king. And if he had been out of temper, unwilling to receive her, her life would have been forfeit. Now, surely those two items suggest that Esther lived in another time and within another social context. As a matter of fact, when we read the scroll of Esther from with a modern eye, more likely than not, we're moved to support the deposed queen, Vashti, and to respect her actions, perhaps even as much as Esther's. But if you remember the story, you'll recall it begins with the fact that Ahasuerus and the nobles of Persia are enjoying, that's the word for it, a drunken brawl. They've been eating and feasting and drinking for 7 days and seven nights. And towards the end of this revel, the king, very much in his cups, begins to boast about the beauty of his queen, about Vashti's comeliness. And he decides, because he thinks that someone might be challenging his word, to summon Vashti before the feasters and the rioters, Harot et Yafya, to reveal to his nobles, his drinking companions, her beauty. And much to her credit, Vashti refuses to come. The company may be noble-born, but at this point they're nothing more than a bunch of drunken bums, and she's not about to expose herself to them. And she's summarily deposed, and she disappears from the book and from history. Now, the king is moved to rationalize his sudden anger at the queen by saying that if he had not deposed her, all of the women of Persia might have been moved to show disrespect to their husbands, and that we can't have happen. And this is Persia, not Israel. But the interesting thing is that when the rabbis and the sages commented on Vashti's behavior, none of them, from the first century before the Common Era down to the 18th century, none of them is moved to ascribe to her noble motives or to give to her the credit which we would say is her due. Quite the contrary. To a man, and all the commentators were men, to a man they say, well, she must have acted out of conceit, or else they say she couldn't come before the king because God had at that moment stricken her with some kind of ugly skin disease, and as punishment for the fact that she had conspired to try and delay the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. To a man, the rabbinic commentators impugn the motives of Vashti, suggesting at the very least that they sympathize with Ahasuerus, that a woman must immediately and completely obey the will of her husband. They're not willing to suggest that a woman's wisdom, a woman's sense of her own dignity, might be an appropriate basis, standard for judgment, when a husband demands of her something that she ought not do, or she is not willing to do. Now, this standard for the action of women becomes even more pointed when we compare the commentators' treatment of Vashti with their treatment of Mordecai. Mordecai and Vashti are in the story guilty of exactly the same sin. Both of them refuse a royal command. Vashti refuses to come and to exhibit herself to the drunken lords, though the king has ordered it. Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman when he's appointed a prime minister, vizier of the court, though the king specifically commands that all members of the court shall bow to his new prime minister. Now, the problem, of course, is that a bow, an acknowledgement of authority, is a convention at the courts of the ancient world. And Mordecai's action might easily be interpreted as simply a matter of a personal pique at Haman. He didn't like the choice, or an overblown sense of his own importance. And the commentators, the same men who interpreted Vashti's behavior in such an unseemly way, go out of their way to free Mordecai of any suggestion that these unworthy motives might have in fact been behind his action. And they go on at great length to describe a large icon, a large religious picture which Haman supposedly wore around his neck, claiming in the process that, of course, if Mordecai had bowed to Haman, he would be bowing to the icon of the god Marduk, and so he would be performing an idolatrous act, and he was acting as a good and faithful, pious Jew. Now, it's a lovely interpretation. But the problem is, of course, that there's nothing in the Book of Esther which suggests to us that Mordecai was a pious Jew. A Jew, of course, but pious not at all. What does Mordecai do? Once the queen is deposed, he encourages his niece Esther to compete for the crown. And what is the prize? Intermarriage. The prize is that she could be the wife of a Persian, Zoroastrian king. And when she enters into the palace, he doesn't go to his friends who are in charge of the harem and say to them, this lovely Jewish girl eats only kosher food. which incidentally is exactly what Daniel and his friends demand when they are in the palace. Not at all. He says to them simply, see to it that she's well made up, that the hairdressers know what they're doing, and those who buy gowns for her see that she's appropriately displayed. There's nothing in the book to suggest that Mordecai was that observant, that pious. And yet the sages, the commentators, go out of their way to impugn virtue to his motives. A double standard, surely. The woman may not disobey. The man, in fact, may. Now, when we look at our tradition's attitude towards women, we're often disturbed by it because we're used to the fact that Judaism was so often on the cutting edge of human ethical sensitivity. When the world was still mired in paganism, we came to the idea of monotheism. When the world still believed that peoples had been created separately, Jews developed the idea of humanity. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? When all kinds and forms of sexual acts were condoned at the courts of Egypt and of Babylonia, the Jew defined ervat davar, unseemly acts, and limited the relationship between men and women to that which was sanctified and holy within the marriage bonds. When the world practiced infanticide, Jews declared life to be sacred. But we're not a perfect people, and nowhere is that more clearly exhibited than in the whole problem of the rights and the role of women. We began pretty well. If we go back into pre-exilic times and you look at a figure like Sarah or Rachel or Ruth, you find women who have independent judgments, who have character. Of course, they have failings, but they have a certain freedom, and they live with their husbands. They're not reduced to the harem. They're not kept apart from the man's world. And we find also in pre-exilic times that there was a woman like Deborah, who was, in effect, the effective chief of all the tribes. And there was a prophet named Huldah whose word was accepted as being the word of God. And there was a woman, a queen named Natalia, who when her husband died, reigned actually had the whole power of the throne in her hands. But after the Babylonian exile, the mood shifts. And women are increasingly demoted, are increasingly reduced in rank, in role, and as to their degree of independence and freedom. Yes, I know that the Bible includes one of the most beautiful poems in all of antiquity to the woman, that beautiful poem which concludes the book of Proverbs, a woman of valor who can find her price is far above rubies. But if you look carefully at this poem, which is in the form of an acrostic, that is, each two lines begin with a succeeding letter of the Hebrew alphabet, you find that the woman who is described here is a homemaker, and nothing is said about any kind of partnership with her husband. She does not share with him in the larger concerns of the community. There's no indication that she goes out with him. She is praised for being diligent, industrious, a good manager, careful of the home, all those things which we feminists today call the enabling role. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. She riseth while it is yet night and gives food to her household. She lays her hand to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She makes for herself coverlets. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed warmly. She looks well to the ways of her household and eats not the bread of idleness. All the enabling roles, And our tradition continuously praises the woman who remains safely within that context. But what of the woman of some independence of mind and of spirit? What of the woman who wants to share her husband's life or in the life of the community? Here we find that our tradition fell behind to a large extent many of the attitudes which appear in the larger world. At the very same time that the Book of Esther was being written, and at the very same time that the basis of rabbinic Judaism was being laid, that is, during the Greco-Roman period, from about the 3rd century before the Common Era, the 4th or 5th century of our era, the Greco-Roman world itself was, to a large degree, undergoing a radical transformation in its ideas about women. If we go back to classic Athens, we find the classic position of the woman. She's to remain at home. That's her place. Her place is very much like the place of the wife in Japan. Now, there were in classic Athens women called heterae, who were courtesans, who went to the feasts with the men and satisfied their desires for entertainment of all kinds. And some of them were known to have been sprightly and to be sparkling in their conversation. But by and large, they were treated as objects. Their role was really that of the geisha in 17th or 18th century Japan. The wife was to breed the legitimate son. Her role was in the home. She never went out socially with her husband. She did not go with him to the theater or to the hippodrome or to the gymnasium. She stayed within the confines of the house. And then, for reasons that we don't yet quite fully understand, a new mood began to come over the Greco-Roman world, a mood which was somewhat romantic, which began to sense the dignity of nature, the dignity of animals, pets, the role of women. And when we read Plato, we find for the first time the suggestion that maybe daughters ought to be educated the same way as sons. Plato indicates that among his students there were two women. And as we go further down into Greco-Roman times, and particularly when we come to Zeno and to the Stoics, who to a large degree provided the popular philosophic base for Hellenistic and Roman culture, we find an emphasis on partnership in marriage. We find an emphasis on the woman sharing with the man in the activities of the community, going with him to theater, going with him out to dinner, to a banquet, going with him to the hippodrome to see the races. We find that in law, women increasingly are allowed to initiate proceedings of marriage and proceedings of divorce. We find that women's testimony is for the first time accepted in the courts. And interestingly, when they uncovered Pompeii, they found on the walls of Pompeii, among the graffiti and the other kinds of banners and etched slogans, they found a number of campaign posters for women who were running for public office. So women were beginning in the 3rd, 2nd, 1st centuries before the Common Era and in Roman times to develop a personality, a persona of their own. And at this very time in Judaism, women were losing those rights which they seem to have had in pre-exilic times. If you look at the book of Job, you get one of the figures of women which features largely in our tradition, the woman who lacks faith, the woman who is the temptress. When Job is bruised by God, it is the wife who says to him, "Curse God and die. Why do you hold fast to your integrity?" But most of all, what you find in the rabbinic tradition is a patriarchal tradition, a tradition where the woman must obey the man, and the woman is to be praised and to be seen in her full glory only when she does those things which serve the man and allow him to enjoy the society which is in fact the dominant one, the one where the major decisions, major status decisions are made. And so we find in the rabbinic tradition that the testimony of a woman is not accepted in court. We find in the rabbinic tradition that a woman may not initiate an act of divorce. We find that though a woman may sometimes say to her father, I do not want to accept this man as my husband, the father need not accept her demurral. We find that the woman is not to be counted in the minyan, the 10 people who are required to make up a congregation. In pre-exilic times in the temple, women and men could go to the same areas. By the second century before the Common Era, women were excluded from entrance into the inner precincts of the temple. In the early synagogue, the synagogue before, say, the destruction of the temple, we have no indication of a mechitza, of any separation of men and women. By the second or third century of the Common Era, there are clear indications that women were kept separate. And rabbinic law, as it developed, was very clear on the fact that many of the rules which are obligatory on men are not obligatory on women. Women need not hear the shofar sounded on Rosh Hashanah. Women need not dwell in the sukkah during the Thanksgiving holiday. Women need not hear the Megillah read on Purim. Women may technically be called up to the reading of the Torah, but the rabbis encourage that they not be for the sake of the congregation. And what we have emerging is what we know existed in Europe in the 19th century. A male-centered, male-dominated, I'm avoiding the word male chauvinist, but that's really what it was, a male-centered Jewish life in which had gone by that time to the degree that those who were particularly concerned about their piety would often, if a woman who was not their wife came into the room, they would simply turn their back and not look at her while she was presenting whatever she had to say. Hamar besicha im ha'isha mevi lidei chet. The rabbi said that one who spends time talking with a woman will almost inevitably be led into sin. Woman is the temptress. Now, this tradition has very little to commend it, although it is now rationalized and justified by many who are within the Orthodox tradition. But it became the dominant one in our tradition, despite the fact that the Jews of the first, second, third centuries lived in and among a Greek culture, a Roman culture, in which women were increasingly being freed, finding a world of their own. How are we to account for this reversion? The answer is we don't really know. We suspect that the rabbis turned against the world about them because from the times of the Maccabees on, they associated the pagan world with acts of infamy, acts of infanticide, acts of idolatry, acts of exposure, homosexuality, all the sexual and religious vices which they feared. And in turning against that world, they disabled themselves from seeing its virtues being preoccupied with its vices. Jewish life, as you know, after the destruction of the temple, turned in on itself for survival. And in that turning in, this tradition was intensified. And so that although during over the ages, though you do find here and there women who are educated in Torah, though here and there you do find men who show great respect for their wives, a great concern for the education of their daughters, the school was a male place. The synagogue was a male place. And those women who achieved a certain independence often achieved a certain notoriety at the same time. They were a danger. And therefore, by and large, Jewish life centered on the man, on having a son. It centered on a woman having her role clearly defined, honorable, but separate, quite set apart. And I think when history ultimately writes the record of Reform Judaism, whatever else it says, it will say that from the very beginning, Reform Judaism caught the mood of the times and caught the sense of virtue, the sense of the right, when it emphasized the personhood of woman. In the very first Reform services in Germany in the 1810s, the mechitza, the separation, was taken away. Women came down from the balcony, and there were family pews. In the very first Reform services in Germany in the 1810s, there was a mixed choir. Men and women sang together. The most important innovation of the Reform movement in the early part of the 19th century was the religious school. Heder was all men. The yeshiva was all men. The religious school was coeducational for the young men and for the young women alike. And confirmation, which was the first ceremony created by Reformed Jews, it was already celebrated in the early 1820s, was created in order to make possible a graduation in which young male students and young female students would graduate as a single class. And not simply, they wouldn't have that separation which the bar mitzvah, which the older forms implied. And I think it's obviously not a matter of chance that by the 1840s, you already had women who were officers of congregations. By the 1860s, you already had women who were presidents of congregations. By the 1920s, you already had in some small congregations in the United States a well-trained rabbi's wives who continued their husband's work once their husbands had died. The congregation did not seek another rabbi. And by the 1960s, you had women enrolled in the rabbinic school and being ordained. And by the 1970s, you had women enrolled in the cantorial school and graduating as cantors. The identification of the personhood of women has been one of the major gifts of Reform Judaism to our tradition. It's an irreversible change. And little by little, you'll find the rest of the tradition, first the conservative world, sometime in the far distant future, the Orthodox world itself, coming along. Because the days of the harem, the days in which women must obey their men, however much some of us might wish for it, are dead and gone and buried. And women today, if they need a model for heroism, can really no longer turn to Esther. Esther's heroism consisted in manipulating her man. Today, women as men must find their heroism by standing for what they believe to be right, struggling for it, and doing what they can in the public arena or in their relationships with family, friends, wherever the courage needs to be shown. The days of manipulation, men, of women by men, of men by women, I would hope were behind us. They're not, of course. But that's the hope. And here we are, a liberated congregation, struggling with all the complex problems of liberation. Who would have believed that such a simple thing as declaring men and women to be equal before God could have such tumultuous effect upon the lives of all of us? We're the generation which is enjoying the change, enduring the change, suffering the change, I hope rejoicing in the fact that change has taken place. It's not easy on us, it's harder on our children, it'll be harder yet on theirs. But God willing, at the end, there will still be little Esthers dressing up for Purim. They won't be thinking too much of these kinds of implications, and perhaps we'll even begin to find little Esthers dressing up as little Mordecais and recognizing that there are many ways which one proves one's courage. Amen.